70 نبيا ثم يجلسون في أسواقهم يبيعون ويشترون كأن لم يصنعوا شيئا، فلم يعجل الله عليهم بل أمهلهم وأخذهم بعد ذلك أخذ عزيز ذي انتقام. اتق الله يا أبا عبد الرحمن ولا تدعن نصرتي.
O Abba Abd al-Rahman, have you not realized that a trait of the despicableness of the world before Allah is that the head of Yahya, son of Zakaria, was given as a gift to one of the adulteresses of the Israelites? Do you not know that the Israelites killed 70 prophets at the time between the dawn and sunrise, and then went to their markets and started buying and selling goods as if they hadn't committed anything? Allah never made haste against them. Rather, He gave them some respite and then got hold of them after that, the grip of a resolute, retributive one. Fear Allah, O Abba Abd al-Rahman, and never deny me your help.
As-salamu alayka ya asir al-qurbat. السلام عليك يا باب نجاة الأمة، السلام عليك يا أسير الكربايات ويا قتيل العبرايات. السلام عليك يا أسير الكربايات ويا قتيل العبرايات. أترجو أمتي قتلت حسينا شفاعة جده يوم الحساب؟ السلام على الخد التريب.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr Rouhani.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وبنستعين صلى الله عليك يا أبو عبد الله. When Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to leave Medina for Mecca, Abdullah ibn Umar, who was the son of Umar, the second caliph, intervened and intended to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Here it must be indicated that there were two or three groups of people who wanted to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Some of them were among the Hashimites, the close relatives of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, because they had known that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam would certainly be martyred at the end of that line. There was another line that wanted to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and wanted to make an stop in the movement of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, and they wanted Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to recognize the tyrant Yazid. Abdullah ibn Umar came forward and intended to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated it to Abdullah ibn Umar that, O Abu Abdurrahman. First of all, it must be indicated that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam addressed Abdullah ibn Umar in a polite way, Ya Abu Abdurrahman, using his patronymic name, I mean kunya, and indicated it that Yahya ibn Zakariya, that is John the Baptist, was martyred, and it was an irony in the world of religions that John the Baptist, who was a prophet, a divine prophet, was martyred and was decapitated, and his head, his severed head, was given to a lady of pleasure in the Israelites, the Jews. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that it wasn't the only practice of the Israelites to martyr John the Baptist. Rather, they killed 70 prophets, I mean, in the early morning, and never felt ashamed of the crime they had committed. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated it to Abdullah ibn Umar in that way. It indicates that the character and career of Abdullah ibn Umar can be determined from this answer of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. And by doing so, by mentioning this, first of all, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to signify it, to stress it, that it wasn't only the case of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to be martyred in the cause of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by such people who claim to be the followers of the Islamic religion. Rather, it had been committed, it had been practiced, it had been done long before the history of Islam, in the history of Judaism. And then we find that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to teach Abdullah ibn Umar that the same fate was going to take place again in the world of Islam in another form. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam addressed Abdullah ibn Umar that he shouldn't deny him his help. It indicates that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was resolute, was determined to move, I mean, to move ahead. And up to now, so far, we've noticed that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam once mentioned the case of Moses of the Prophet. And again, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam highlighted the case of John the Baptist, who was martyred. It indicates that Imam al-Husayn's movement was in the line of the divine prophets, and the martyrdom wasn't his only fate. Rather, martyrdom was the fate of John the Baptist and 70 other prophets among the Israelites. Sallallahu alayhi ya Abu Abdullah.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Husayn today and always.
In the limelight.
As the U.S. government is left scrambling, watching its $2.2 trillion war effort turn out to have meant nothing, and seeking to pick up the pieces, It is now behaving very dangerously. The U.S. may not have a physical presence inside of Afghanistan in the future, but the fear is that its economic sanctions may end up being more deadly than its armed forces, says Robert, an English journalist, in an article titled, Freezing Afghanistan's Wealth, U.S. Scrambles to Hit Hard with Soft Power. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In keeping with the U.S. administration's pledge to withdraw from America's 20-year war in one of the poorest countries on Earth, the U.S. regime has yet to present any plan for future relations with Afghanistan, as it is reportedly scrambling to freeze Kabul's wealth for fears of it falling into the hands of the Taliban. In the midst of the sudden collapse of Afghanistan's government, and the subsequent return to power of the Taliban recently, the U.S. troop presence at Afghanistan's Kabul airport has reportedly increased to 4,500 strong, with a further increase planned to 6,000 in coming days. Having abandoned its embassy in the Afghan capital and vowing to maintain a presence only at the country's airport, the U.S. regime has severely miscalculated the pace at which the country was destined to fall into the Taliban control. An unnamed U.S. official speaking to the Washington Post said, any central bank assets the Afghan government have in the United States will not be made available to the Taliban. According to that same report, the U.S. administration has now frozen the assets of Afghanistan, the vast majority of which are not held inside of the nation's own borders. Some 80% of Afghanistan's annual budget is currently funded by the United States and other foreign governments, which may well end now that the Taliban have seized control of the country. In alignment with sanctions in place against the Taliban and Executive Order 13224, any dealings with the Taliban are prohibited. Executive Order 13224 was signed by then-President George W. Bush in the wake of the September 11th attacks and was said to have been designed to restrict financing to U.S.-designated terrorist organizations. This means that for one of the poorest countries on the planet, it may now be even more difficult to bring in international humanitarian aid at a time when the ongoing refugee crisis is expected to escalate. On May 6, 2019, the UN Human Rights Council, commenting on the implementation of sanctions against Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba, stated that the use of economic sanctions by the U.S. government for political purposes violates human rights and the norms of international behavior. It also warned that such actions threaten creation of man-made humanitarian catastrophes of unprecedented proportions. Over the past two decades, successive U.S. administrations have fueled their project in Afghanistan, working to build an Afghan military 300,000 strong, armed with some of the latest in U.S. military equipment. Between 2001 and 2019, the U.S. regime spent $133 billion on its nation-building efforts in Afghanistan. Taliban now seems to be taking a more pragmatic approach to politics, showing themselves to be more calculated than they previously were. Yet, skepticism is still high as to whether the group will carry through with pledges to maintain peace and to respect the rights of women. the U.S. regime is left scrambling, watching its $2.2 trillion war effort turn out to have meant nothing, and seeking to pick up the pieces, it is now behaving very dangerously. Having utilized the U.S. Air Force against the Taliban during the past month, now holding back the wealth of Afghanistan, the U.S. regime is taking a much more aggressive approach than that of its rivals. The U.S. regime may not have a physical presence inside of Afghanistan in the future, but the fear is that its economic sanctions may end up being more deadly than its armed forces.
When we go through this book, we find that Mr. Azizullah Attaroodi is trying to collect every sentence quoted regarding Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam or from Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the books.
For example, if you want to read something about Imam Hussein, you don't know where to find it, which book you can find the information you are looking for. But Musnad stands for compiling everything which is related to Imam Hussein.
Familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the teacher you are listening to. Please accept our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the month of Muharram. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyainia. Sheikh Mahtavi, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Ziyainia, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Let me express my condolences on the occasion of martyrdom of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam and his great companions.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about an author who dedicated one of his most outstanding works to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. He is no one but the late Azizullah Attaroodi, and his magnum opus or work, Musnad al-Imam al-Shahid Abu Abdullah al-Hussein. Sheikh Ziyainia, let's start with you for this episode. What information can you give us about Musnad al-Imam al-Shahid Abu Abdullah al-Hussein?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If I want to give a briefing of the content of the book, I should mention that this book is consisting of three volumes. So the first volume is starting with the narrations regarding the birth of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. The beginning moment of the life of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, and then it moves to his names, his titles, and his virtues, and his imamat, and it goes forward some narrations regarding photos, regarding the bravery of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam in battlefields, and his attributes, his personal life.
Very good.
Then after this, Mr. Azizullah Attaroodi is emphasizing of this issue that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is not an ordinary figure. So he says that, for example, the chapter 19, for example, he quotes this riwayat that an-Rasul yasqa al-Hussein alayhi salam. the Holy Prophet is the one who was giving water to Abu Abdullah Hussein alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. You know, he is wisely is trying to give us this, you know, image that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is a special figure, that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam was looking at him in a very, very special way.
That's all right.
Giving him a special position.
That's right.
But this great figure that the Holy Prophet was giving water to him mm-hmm. was neglected by Muslim society just 50 years after the demise of the Holy Prophet.
That's all right. So this is, as you said, this book consists, and this musnad consists of three volumes. Number one is his general background.
Yes.
As I have it over here, the second one is Ahadith al-Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on different topics. It could be Akhlaq, Ahkam one. And the third one is a collection of the narrators of these Ahadith of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Also, there is an epilogue or the ending to that, which is talking about some of the poets who composed some poems regarding Sayyid al-Shuhada. Sheikh Mahtabi, this book, and other musnads, I think I've heard that Azizullah Taridi have also musnads about the other imams. What do you think the importance of writing this musnad type of thing for imams is, especially for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? What is the significance?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, before I mention what you asked for, brother, let me just tell Azizullah Taridi, may Allah bless him, is one who did kind of musnad, as my brother mentioned, for all of the Ahlul Bayt. We may say something that he wrote a kind of musnad, compiled the riwayat of Ahlul Bayt in the book which is called Musnad. But when it comes to details, we see, for example, for Imam Ali, it's a kind of huge book, mm-hmm. 25 volumes.
Wow.
He wrote only for Imam Ali. Then, for example, for Imam Hussein, as you mentioned, 3 volumes.
That's right.
Imam Sajjad, 2 volumes. Imam Baqir, 6 volumes. Again, Imam Sadiq, 22 volumes.
Wow.
These ulama that you are reading their books, if you put their works top of each other, you cannot jump over their works.
Oh.
So just imagine, it is mentioned, for example, for late Ataridi, that he published more than 100 books.
That's right.
So under 50 titles.
That's right.
So that is a huge contribution that he did,
yes,
for Islamic library.
For Islamic that is library.
Very, yeah, okay. That is very important point that we have to take into consideration. But with respect to the question that you said,
yes,
that what is the significance of,
yes,
of Musnad, it is really important for a researcher. For example, if you want to read something about Imam Hussein, you don't know where to find it, which book you can find the information you are looking for. But Musnad stands for compiling everything which is related to the life of Imam
That's
Hussein,
right,
the sayings of Imam Hussein, the companions of Imam Hussein, everything which is related with a slight relationship to Imam Hussein is compiled in the Musnad book.
This is like an encyclopedia.
Yeah,
I
wanted to mention, I wanted to say it, it's a kind of encyclopedia. So yes, it's really easy. Through the alphabetic name you can find it, but you have to follow the order of,
yes,
the book. As my brother mentioned, the information in these three books could,
that's
be
right,
classified in three chapters that,
that's
you
right,
also mentioned. The first chapter is dedicated to,
yes,
merits, names,
yes,
and things of the titles of Imam Hussein. The second volume is with respect to the sayings of,
that's
Imam,
right,
Hussein.
I don't fear if from your cradle you depart. You sleep in the deepest oceans of my heart. But if for only a second from me you part, each ocean in my heart would be torn apart.
And especially about the case of Imam al-Hussein is that in this musnad and these authentic resources related to the statements of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, when he left Mecca, Medina for Karbala, all these documents and the sayings and statements of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam show that how much he was after correcting the Muslim Ummah. We have different documents. He started by saying some words by the shrine of Prophet Muhammad, then Omar al-Atraf, his stepbrother, then Ummah Salama, you know, and all the people that come here and there, these stations that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam stays on the way to Karbala and give the lectures and the sermons that he gave the night before among the companions. You are free to go. Whoever is ready to go is permitted to go and leave me and this and that. You know, the special case about Musnad and writing Musnad about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is that it gives Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam qiyam and movement a kind of authenticity and shows that how Imam, through his words and actions both, was after correcting the Islamic Ummah. This, I think, Mr. Attaruddin's book, that is Musnad Imam al-Shahid, helped us very much in this regard. Sheikh Zia, any other remarks regarding his book?
To complete your nice points, I should say that this kind of Musnad is somehow an stream that if we go through in it and go with it, we will start from the point of the birth of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam to the martyrdom of His Holiness and also the events that happened after his martyrdom, right, and also the fadila and thawab of ziyarat of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam, and even how to do ziyarat for him,
right,
and many other different issues that in a sentence, anything that is related to Abu Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam.
May Allah give us the chance of visiting the shrine of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the city of Karbala during the month of Muharram, and being present in the majalis of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, inshallah. This is really a good chance. During the pandemic, the COVID pandemic, unfortunately, most of the visitors to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam are banned from going there, or they have to observe the protocols. But the case is that I think even from far, far away, you can pay visit and homage to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And the case is that scholars like Azizullah Attaruddin help us to give us a picture of what happened to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam through, I say, the literary heritage of the Aimmas. And unfortunately, the best of the people of Allah on the earth were killed and martyred by the worst people on earth. And this is really a tragedy for us.
I also would like to tell that our dear listeners have access to this book through the internet. They can find the book, the digital copy of the book, in NurLib and also libishia.ir.
That's all very good. This book is written in Arabic language.
And also translated in Farsi.
In Farsi language, that's right. But NurLib, as you said, is a big, big digital library. Most of the references, the Shia ones, are available online through software or the PDF format. That's great. Thank you very much for the information. It was very kind of Sheikh Mahdavi. May Allah help us to be among the faithful followers of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam's teachings and his trainings. And may Allah bless the soul of the late Azizullah Attaruddin. Thank you very much, Sheikh Ziya.
You're welcome. Thank you
for your presence in the program, the teacher, and Sheikh Mahdavi. Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. Please accept again our condolences on the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and the month of Muharram. Do not forget us in your du'as and supplications and azadaris in the majalis and the takaya that you go during these days in the month of Muharram. You can visit our website for more information on this program and our previous episodes and download them for free at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also, you can visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode and another dignitary and famous personality of Shia world, God bless you all. Fi amanullah. Assalamu alaikum ya Abu Abdullah.
standing all alone,
standing all alone
in Karbala. She sees burning tents, and remembers Zahra. She remembers Zahra. Ablaze, alone here I stand, no one left to embrace. Both my feet are being burned by the sand, and fire scorches my face. Today someone else is
paying. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
The United States faced mounting global pressure on Monday, 23rd of August, to extend its evacuation mission in Afghanistan past President Biden's August 31st deadline, despite a Taliban warning against doing so. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Washington Post journalists Missy Ryan, Anne Geeran, Karun Demirjian, and Dan Lamoff. The piece is titled, Biden Faces Pressure to Extend Afghanistan Evacuation Mission as Taliban Warns Against Doing So. United States faced mounting global pressure on Monday, 23rd of August, to extend its evacuation mission in Afghanistan past President Joe Biden's 31st of August deadline, despite a Taliban warning against doing so. The admonition from Taliban spokesman Sohail Shaheen, who cautioned that foreign forces would be subject to consequences should they remain in Kabul into September, came as the U.S. military accelerated flights out of the Afghan capital, following a week of chaos and insecurity that thwarted attempts by thousands of foreigners and desperate Afghans to depart from Kabul. If they extend it, that means they're extending the occupation, Taliban spokesman Sohail Shaheen told Sky News. If they're intent on continuing the occupation, it will provoke a reaction. The remarks add a new element of risk to Joe Biden's efforts to contain the fallout from the Taliban's surprise takeover of Afghanistan just 8 days ago, a turn that has ignited a public reckoning over the manner in which the president withdrew American forces from Afghanistan. The militants' resistance to any prolonged foreign presence injected fresh uncertainty into international coordination efforts a day before Biden holds crisis talks with leaders from the Group of Seven industrialized countries. British officials have said that Prime Minister Boris Johnson will use the emergency meeting to propose new sanctions on the Taliban and push President Biden to extend the evacuation operation. President Biden's National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan told reporters on Monday that the United States could finish its evacuation of Americans by the current deadline of 31st of August, which Joe Biden set this spring. As I've said before, as the President has said before, we believe that we have time between now and the 31st of August to get out any American who wants to get out, Jake Sullivan said. The administration does not know exactly how many Americans are in Afghanistan, nor how many want to leave the country, officials have confirmed. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan declined to say what Joe Biden will tell Boris Johnson on Tuesday, 24th of August, about extending the deadline for evacuations from Afghanistan. Wallace, Britain's defense secretary, has said that Britain, like other nations reliant on U.S. air and manpower in Afghanistan, will be forced to end its own evacuation effort when the United States departs. It's really important for people to understand that the United States have over 6,000 people in Kabul airport, and when they withdraw, that will take away the framework, and we will have to go as well, Ben Wallace said. France is also appealing for more time. On Monday, 23rd of August, the French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian said he was concerned by the timeline. French President Emmanuel Macron, in a phone call with Joe Biden on Friday, stressed a collective moral responsibility to vulnerable Afghans. "We cannot abandon them," Macron said, according to the French embassy. While Joe Biden has resisted committing to changing his departure deadline, his aides are increasingly preparing for such a step. Officials said on Monday, 23rd of August, that an extension, if authorized, would probably have a narrow focus on evacuating remaining Americans and not the much larger group of Afghans who want to escape the country. One official, who like others spoke on the condition of anonymity to describe internal planning, said any extension would be brief and likely to end before the 20th anniversary of the 11th of September 2001 attacks. Hanging over the deliberations is a possibility that the Taliban, newly emboldened as it takes charge of the Afghan state, would respond to a continued foreign footprint by not only suspending its cooperation with the evacuation operation, but also targeting foreign troops at Kabul airport. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the Biden administration is in daily communication with Taliban officials, but declined to say what their private message had been regarding the possibility of a prolonged U.S. presence at Kabul airport. "We are taking this day by day," Jake Sullivan said. "We're going to keep making progress, and the president will ultimately make his decision about the precise shape and scope of the operation." The situation in Afghanistan has led to strains with European allies at a time when the Biden administration hoped to repair relations that it said were damaged under former President Donald Trump. some NATO officials now scrambling to get their own staff and local employees to safety have complained that they weren't properly consulted before Joe Biden's decision to leave Afghanistan. Discussions about an extended mission are occurring at the pace of evacuations finally gained speed. On Monday, officials said the military had evacuated nearly 11,000 people over the previous 24 hours, a major increase from previous days, when problems with airport access, passenger processing, and security threats slowed down or sometimes halted airlift operations altogether. It was the first time the military had met and in fact exceeded its goal of 5,000 to 9,000 evacuations per day. While most of those airlifted are being processed at military bases in the Persian Gulf countries or in Europe, at least several plane loads of Afghans have already landed in the United States. Diplomats are also making arrangements with countries from Europe to South America to take in Afghan refugees, at least temporarily. Even as flights ramped up, conditions remained trying for Afghans attempting to reach the relative safety of Hamid Karzai International Airport in Kabul, where U.S. troops are now stationed along with forces from Turkey, Britain, France, and various other countries. A U.S. official familiar with conditions on the ground said entry points to the airport remained closed on Monday to most, if not all, Afghans who work for the United States and are seeking refugee status under the Special Immigrant Visa or SIV program. Some members of Afghanistan's military are now attempting to flee as evacuees as well, the official confirmed. Communication problems have further hampered the effort. Phone reception at Kabul airport is poor as thousands of Afghans crowd in overwhelming cell towers. Even as officials work to standardize the entry process, individuals with knowledge of the conditions said the procedures for admitting people from the crowd at the gates of the airport remain inconsistent. Some interpreters or former Afghan troops continue to say they got in only because one-time colleagues inside the perimeter recognized them, not through any fixed procedure. Happenstance and luck is not a way to plan an airlift, said Jack McCain, a former advisor to the Afghan Air Force. Jack McCain added, "It's a sea of crushing humanity with no rhyme or reason." The Pentagon said U.S. troops had made multiple sorties beyond Kabul airport to reach stranded Americans. Speaking to reporters on Monday, 23rd of August, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby said that a second group of Americans had been airlifted into the airport following another operation last week, and that rescue sorties were being employed as needed to bring more inside the perimeter of the airport. "I don't want to leave you with the idea that we're patrolling the streets of Kabul," John Kirby said. He cautioned, and he said that the military was using a variety of methods to extract Americans from the city. The presence around the airport of Taliban foot soldiers, who have in some cases beaten or threatened Afghans attempting to gain entry into the airport, has deterred others from attempting to escape, according to the accounts of Afghans. While the Taliban has promised amnesty for Afghans linked to foreign nations, reports have intensified of Taliban fighters searching for and arresting them. In addition to a firefight that occurred at the airport on Monday, it appeared that the Taliban shot and killed several SIV applicants nearby and were collecting information from Afghans in the crowd, said an official familiar with conditions on the ground at the airport. "What's that saying? The fox is in the hen house," the official said. The official acknowledged that the increased number of people flying out had helped but still considered progress fragile. Every day is a new terrible adventure, the official said.
Lately, the UN-affiliated Pan American Health Organization reported that COVID cases are accelerating in North America, driven primarily by a surge in southern and eastern United States and central Mexico. The spike is blamed on the highly infectious Delta variant of the virus. The organization stated that COVID cases in the United States are up by a third. The United States is currently the worst-hit nation in the world in terms of infections and fatalities. So, who is to blame for this situation? Last week, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick blamed the unvaccinated African-American community for the latest COVID surge. The Lieutenant Governor's remarks drew criticism, as some called his assertion baseless. The latest data from the state of Texas Department of Health Services shows the highest coronavirus case rates are among whites and Hispanics, who make up over 70% of the state's cases, not the African-Americans. Meanwhile, African Americans are more prone to the COVID-19 as they are twice as likely to die compared to their white counterparts. For instance, in the capital, Washington, D.C., African Americans account for 76% of the COVID deaths, while they make up less than half of the population. In addition, they are less likely to get vaccinated amid the variant spreads. African Americans have received smaller shares of vaccinations compared to their shares of cases and the total population. Out of the 58% of people who had received at least one dose of the vaccine, nearly two-thirds are white, and only 10% are African Americans. But COVID-19 is not the only problem they are facing. As the pandemic started last year, many working-class African Americans struggled with housing costs and faced eviction, as rent rates increased faster than their incomes. That's the best example of economic inequality in American society. Another issue that has plagued American society is racial discrimination and police brutality. According to various studies, African Americans are far more likely to be shot, arrested, and imprisoned by police than any other racial group. Many African Americans are reluctant to receive COVID jabs. This unwillingness is the result of distrust that formed after centuries of injustice toward African American communities. Vaccine hesitancy among African Americans is rooted in the historical mistreatment of the community by the U.S. government and medical institutions. One of the most horrific chapters in U.S. history is the infamous Tuskegee experiment. In 1972, a report exposed that the U.S. Public Health Service had conducted a 40-year experiment at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama on hundreds of impoverished black men with syphilis. They were deliberately left untreated so doctors could study the disease. Many of the men died of syphilis and its complications. Some of their wives and babies were infected as well.
What was done cannot be undone. But we can end the silence. We can stop turning our heads away. We can look at you in the eye and finally say, on behalf of the American people, what the United States government did was shameful, and I am sorry.
The experiment added to the deep distrust many African Americans have toward the federal government.
Yeah, because, you know, this idea of brutality, colonial brutality, has persisted throughout the history here. I mean, I know that some people would like to talk about Tuskegee, the Tuskegee experiment that lasted for 40 years here in the United States of America from 1932 to 1972, where white people used African men as test studies for the development of syphilis in human beings. And so some people say that our distrust, is, being African people's distrust, is based on that kind of history. But again, African people all around the world have sense enough not to trust anything that the colonizer says is good for us, because nothing they've ever said is good for us has been.
Racism and injustice, unethical medical experiments, and slavery all have contributed to the distrust that was in making for centuries. Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, an ambitious $11 billion project that would transport natural gas from Russia directly to Germany by bypassing Ukraine. The project will double the existing Nord Stream pipeline running from Russia to Europe across the Baltic Sea, and is a sustainable way to ensure European energy security. The Nord Stream 2 project is close to completion, yet it has for long caused tensions between Moscow and Washington. The United States sees the project as a potential threat, believing that it will increase Europe's dependence on Russian gas exports and isolate Ukraine. As a matter of fact, by bypassing Ukraine, Russia and the European Union could save the transit fees that make up to 3% of Ukraine's GDP. In addition, Washington worries that Moscow's success in transferring natural gas to Europe would undermine the effectiveness of U.S. sanctions in place against the country since 2014 due to the conflict in Ukraine. On Friday, Washington slapped new sanctions on a ship and two entities involved in the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project. At the same time, U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order allowing for sanctions to be imposed on certain Russian officials. Although this deepens the rift between the U.S. and Russia, it is unlikely to have much impact on the nearly completed energy project. The U.S. and Germany had struck an agreement when it came to Nord Stream 2. The Biden administration waived sanctions on the company overseeing the construction of the pipeline and its chief operating officer, yet it goes ahead with sanctioning Russian officials. It appears that the U.S. is still after sabotaging this project.
But basically, they're trying to look tough, even though they're kind of surrendering, because it's clear that the Nord Stream will take place. Who is very much kind of stand to lose as a result of that is Ukraine, because, you know, Ukraine utilizing the oil pipeline, more or less 20% of their income depends on that. So Ukraine is going to lose money, and that's what the United States' interest is. They ask Germany to help. They don't want to pay themselves, so they push Germany to help Ukraine. But so that's the bottom line. But, you know, so they can sanction the Russians, but they more or less will have to agree with the Nord Stream to go on.
Britain and the U.S. both targeted seven Russians with sanctions and also issued a joint statement warning Russia over chemical weapons. The targeted Russian individuals are described as Russian security officials allegedly involved in a nerve attack on Navalny last year. This is while Moscow has denied any involvement in the incident. Washington separately imposed sanctions on another two men and four Russian institutes it said were involved in chemical weapons research or what it described as an assassination attempt against Navalny. Navalny was poisoned using a nerve agent. He was flown to Germany for medical treatment after falling ill in Siberia on August 20th last year. Though he survived, he was arrested in January when he returned to Russia. The U.S. has been on the forefront with anti-Russia rhetoric over Navalny's case, including his alleged poisoning. This is while Kremlin has said it will not allow any foreign interference in its domestic affairs. In response to the latest round of sanctions over Nord Stream 2 and the Navalny case, Russian Foreign Ministry condemned the measures as unilateral and illegitimate, vowing that Moscow's response to sanctions will be tough and appropriate.
developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days, following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned the Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Well, obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan. And there was really never a concerted effort. There were attempts every now and then, you know, to do destroy fields and to, you know, persuade the farmers to produce, you know, corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades. The United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital Kabul faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
A shocking United Nations climate report has sounded a serious warning about global warming, saying that humans are explicitly to blame for irreversible climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described the report as a code red for humanity and urged an end to the use of coal and fossil fuels. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has concluded that the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature goal of the Paris Agreement would likely be breached by 2030, a decade sooner than it projected just 3 years ago. Countries